Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. I'm here with Device Talks Managing Editor Kayleen Brown. Kayleen, great to have you back on the intro.
Hey, you can't keep me away now, Tom.
Too much energy, too much excitement. Kayleen, I don't know if you noticed, I know you're an avid listener of the podcast. And
yes, that's well established.
I'm dropping podcasts. I want to just call this Device Talks Weekly. I feel like we've moved past, to a degree, the podcast category, because we've got so many features on this. We'll have Chris Newmarker and his Newmarker's Newsmakers from Mass Device. We'll have our FOMO series, which is my conversation with David Nilwani of NVIDIA. We talked to him at Device Talks Boston. And then we have Ken Charhut of Foldax. And Foldax is a really cool company working on hard valve. So like, I guess when I think podcast, I think it's either one thing, maybe a roundtable or an interview. I think we've got like so many different features here. I just want to say Device Talks Weekly and just kind of treat it as a show. What do you think? Should we go with that?
Absolutely. I mean, if we're not evolving, then are we really med tech? I mean, it has to be innovation, innovation, innovation.
Amen.
And, you know, this thought that you have is actually, I think, would be very well received. So we just got news that we are now number 14 in the top 100 tech news from GoodPods.
There
and it's
go.
The tech news. So I think they're even inspired by the idea that it's not maybe a podcast, but it's a show. So well on us. Thank you to our audience, to our Device Talkers for listening and for embracing this show that we try to bring you every week.
It's absolutely
clearly being appreciated. So thank you.
It's a joy of ours, and one we'll continue to do. But of course, we really would love to see everyone in person, and we'll be able to do that at Device Talks West. And listeners of our podcast know that they get a little bit of a discount if they use the code DTWeekly25 when they register. So if you haven't signed up yet, go to west.devicetalks.com to register for Device Talks West. It's happening October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. We will have NVIDIA there. We'll have Johnson & Johnson MedTech. We'll have Moon Surgical. We'll have Stanford. We'll have Johnson & Johnson, I said, Abbott, Boston Scientific, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be a great program. Folks can check out the agenda. So, Kayleen, will you hang around for a couple of more transitions?
Oh, just try to keep me away. Impossible.
All right.
I'm locked in.
Folks, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. How you doing?
I'm a little tired, I'll be honest. Drove out to near Purdue. We left Boston Monday at noon.
Wow.
Spent the first night in Cooperstown, New York. Hit the Hall of Fame on Tuesday,
which was
fun. I love baseball. I love the Red Sox.
Oh yeah.
I'm not like a huge like memorabilia guy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's kind of cool to see Curt Schilling's cleats from Game 2 of the World Series. But I'm like, beyond like, you're like, okay, that's cool.
And then you don't have a box set of Ken Burns' baseball documentary?
Although I enjoyed the series. It was great.
It's a nice series.
It's not running on a loop in my house or anything like that.
Not running on the loop. Like.
So that was good. Like, and
what was the best Red Sox team? Like 1905, probably 1912.
I mean, they won the first World Series, and then they were like the Celtics of the early 1900s, the 19-aughts, I guess it would be. Is that
the right? Aughts, the 19-aughts.
They ruled the aughts.
The good old days.
Yeah. We loved the aughts. The aughts were awesome. They were aughts. Awesome.
They're awesome.
Oh Lordy.
Wow.
And then we spent the next night in Madison, Ohio.
Oh.
So we stayed right outside of Cleveland. East of Cleveland.
Okay.
To Duffy's Tavern.
Duffy's Tavern.
A very nice little meal for $34 was
wow.
I know. I like tech.
That's a deal.
I felt like I time traveled to 1993. It was extraordinary.
You weren't like splitting a grilled cheese sandwich or something.
Beers. The beers are
full. Oh my gosh.
I know. So, and they had a special on burgers, $2 burgers on Tuesdays.
What?
And whatever drink. I know. It was great.
My gosh. So,
if, folks, if you're on Route 90, you're going through, about to hit Cleveland, but you need to stop for dinner.
Nice.
I highly recommend Duffy's Tavern in Madison. That's
amazing.
Ohio. It was great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then he dropped me off at the Cleveland airport and then did the rest of the drive himself. So,
Oh, that's nice. He dropped you off at the airport.
Well, if I go all the way to Purdue, then he has to either drive me to Indianapolis
or
O'Hare. And it's 2 hours one way or 2 hours the other. So, a 4 hour trip from either way. So, he's either driving 4 hours to get to Purdue and then he stays there, or he's next day driving me one way or the other. So
he doesn't have that much farther to go anyway. I mean, the Ohio Turnpike's a nice straight shot.
It's a straight shot, but as he said, it was kind of endless. Like, Ohio goes on for quite a while.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of Ohio. There's a lot of Ohio.
I was reminiscing the other day because, I mean, I grew up north of Columbus and I was reminiscing how there is like a part of me that misses the wide open space, like just like the endless cornfields. There is something about that. You're like now that I live, you know, around the Twin Cities and it's more hilly or whatever.
Yeah.
You do have that, like, there's something different when you're just like, wow, like the land's just stretching on forever with corn, soybean.
Exactly. For a guy from the Northeast where, like, you hills and trees, like for me to I'm giddy when I drive through those cornfields, especially when I did it one winter going to see a February game.
Nice.
Wide open expanse, and you can see if there's any police around. It's pretty easy to spot a cop.
That's true, so, yeah.
Like, get a little head of steam going if you want and make it a little more fun. So
there you go. Maybe get. I'll try to outrun them, Tom. No, don't do that. I don't want to. That's good times.
We've wasted these good people's time.
I know.
Let's roll into the Newmarket's newsmakers. Chris Newmarket, what is number five on this vaunted award-winning list?
Well, number five on the list, this is by associate editor. No, I'm, I caught, what did I do? Senior editor, Sean Hooley. Sean
dun,
Hooley.
Dun, dun.
Congrats, promoted. Yep. So, yep. Sean, senior editor, Sean Hooley, wrote, article about NovaCure, which is a company we've been covering, you know, for a few years now. Jim Hammerin over at MDO had a really good piece back in 2023 talking about their technology, but they have these what they call their TT fields, these electrical fields that get delivered to a tumor site, to basically help combat cancer, and they already had FDA approval for it. To help treat non-small lung cancer. Now they're seeking an FDA PMA for it to treat locally advanced pancreatic cancer, which is one of the most. It's definitely an extremely serious cancer to have pancreatic cancer. So they're seeking approval with that. So it's great to see this technology advancing.
Absolutely. Now, NovaCure is definitely one of those great med tech stories that we love to talk about, using technology to do things that drugs can. I know at MassMedics Gala last year, they had a speaker, Mike Hugo, who has glioblastoma, and he talked about how NovaCure is he wears the device most of the day, if not nearly all of the day.
Wow.
And it's really extended his life. And he talked about the impact of that. He has young kids. It's a really heartrending story. And it's
wow,
just great to see NovaCure making more progress. So it is, as I said, a great med tech story. So
yeah, it's great.
Worthy number five, Chris Newmarket.
All right. Let's see if we can keep it up. The number four, we have a NeuroOne, based in my neck of the woods, outside of Minnesota and Eden Prairie, outside of Minneapolis, sorry, in Eden Prairie. They just won an FDA clearance for their 1RF trigeminal nerve ablation system. And the clearance is for it to treat, facial pain. And this, the system, it creates RF lesions, to treat pain, or it can, you know, provide lesioning of nerve tissue so that for, you know, functional neurosurgical procedures. So just a really, really good clearance for a Neuro One here.
All right, great. Well, more interesting applications of RF energy. We've seen a lot of that in renal renovation and other spaces. So there's things that need to be treated that I'm really never aware of even existing. So
yeah.
One thing that's always been great about this industry is understanding. I don't know if great's the right term, but there's so many folks out there who are suffering with maladies that need help. Neuro One is definitely targeting an important one for sure.
Well, you know, and not just these applications, but also the fact that these are this is just part of this whole trend that we're seeing, that there's so many, you know, procedures that used to be much more invasive, and now all of a sudden we're seeing a lot more, you know, stuff that's much more minimally invasive. Uh-huh. Like this, that can get delivered, like whether it's something surgical, or like an ablation or whatnot, or deploying a valve. I mean, just all kinds of really really, really cool stuff going on. And, you know, it's great. These are the type of procedures that aren't going to have somebody in the hospital for a long period of time.
Absolutely. All right. And speaking of RF and ablation sort of denervation, takes us into number three.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was news out last week by senior editor Daniel Kirsch, but it's getting, it continues to get a lot of attention on Mass Device, and that's that the, this renal denervation, here we go. This is the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. They've updated their hypertension guidelines now to include renal denervation as a treatment option, for certain people who have just this really resistant high blood pressure that, is hard to control with drugs. So, just another step forward for this technology Medtronic has its Simplicity Spiral, which uses RF energy for renal denervation. And then we also have Recor Medical out there with their Paradise system that uses ultrasound for the procedure. But just a lot of promise around this technology, and something that these companies have been describing as a multi-billion-dollar industry, because hypertension is widespread among people mm-hmm. as they get older. So
we had Ray Cohen on our Device Talks Tuesdays interventional series back in July, and yeah, he sees renal denervation as really the next big med tech market, multi-billion-dollar market. So
yeah,
this will certainly help it get on its way. So, all right.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Number three. Let's roll on to number two, Chris Newmark.
Hey, number two. This was a story out last week by Sean. And this was, Philips. They're going to be, investing more than $150 million in U.S. Manufacturing and R&D efforts. A lot of this, centered around AI-powered med techs. So, some good news. I mean, Philips has had kind of a rough road in recent years with that huge CPAPs recall, but there's a lot of promise around what AI could potentially do in med tech, and it's great to see a big company like Philips. It's based out of the Netherlands, but they're going to be doing a really good investment in the United States. And they're saying this is coming on top of the nearly $1 billion a year that they spend on R&D and, around the United States. So just good news. It's going to be centered, this $150 million investment, it includes Reedville in Pennsylvania. And it also includes, not too far from where I live, they expanded image-guided therapy facility, in Plymouth, so in Minnesota.
Absolutely. You covered everything I was going to say. I'll just add Jim Hammerin had a great article conversation with Philips Chief Innovation and Strategy Officer Shez Partovi back in May. So folks want to check that out on Medical Design and Outsourcing. There's a link to it in Sean's article. So great news from Philips, and lots of R&D spending in the U.S. I didn't see any kind of mention of it being tariffs related or anything. I mean, it sounds like if they already had $1 billion going in, that this is just a priority of theirs, but no matter the reason, it's great to have investment in U.S. R&D.
I haven't yet done a really more scientific analysis, but just following the news around medtech and pharma, I am noticing a lot more like announcements of like, oh, we're doing more in the US. Oh, we're doing more in the US. Like we've been seeing more of that this year.
Could be could be there's more of it. It could be we're just noticing it because we're attuned to it. It could be that they would have done it before. I think they would have announced it anyway, but if someone
maybe not us.
Yeah. If someone is doing it nowadays, they're certainly gonna crow about it. And I don't blame them. I mean that's the way to win points nowadays. So
yeah. Versus like if you're saying you're not doing it, then you risk things can
or
get.
If you're doing it and not touting it, then you're not getting the recognition you deserve. So I got no problem with them touting it. I think it's great.
Yeah. Hey,
it's great news. So all right.
If a tree falls in the forest and no one's around, right, you gotta
Press release is an issue. Did it actually actually fall?
The press release was an issue. Right.
What is what's number one, Chris Neumarker?
Well, number one, this is from yours truly. I covered Medtronic's first quarter earnings report this week, and man, they had news. They definitely had news. They it looks like they're working with a activist investor, Elliott Investment Management. Elliott actually, got some news last year because it was a little more contentious. They were kind of had a little bit of a tussle about getting extra board seats over at Southwest Airlines. But it looks like in the case of Medtronic, they're working with them, and they announced they'll be adding two new board members, medtech veterans, to their board.
And who are the veterans that they're adding, Chris Neumarker?
Well, they are adding former Hillrom CEO John Grotelaars, I believe is.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Yeah, forgive us, John, if we get in.
E L A A R S.
Yes, and then former Stryker CFO Bill Jellison is joining the board as well, and they're creating two new special board committees. One that's going to be focused on growth, especially like examining potential tuck-in M&A opportunities. We haven't seen a lot of that from Medtronic in over the last year or two, so that's kind of interesting. Like we might be seeing more tuck-in M&As from Medtronic potentially, as well as like how to focus more of their R&D spending. And I'd also add, like if you go over to medical design outsourcing, we have a really good analysis that we posted recently, about how like overall like R&D spending in medtech is it's really the growth has really slowed down over the past year. It's neat to see Medtronic at least figuring out maybe how to focus some more of that. So that's a good deal. So
it's interesting to have. I mean, whenever you hear an activist investor is involved, it tends to be a multi-chaptered story. So the way this is being presented, it's like this is a singular event. But we'll have to see if there's more of it. I mean, I don't know. We've talked about the MiniMed spin out. I wonder if I don't know when Elliott became an investor. I wonder if their involvement kind of forced to look inward. I mean, the spin out was talked about for a long time, so I'm not saying they instigated it, but having an activist investor involved with one of MedTech's largest company.
Yeah, still the largest company.
Is still a very interesting development, and one that I suspect we'll be hearing more of in the future, but we'll see. Maybe this will be the end of it.
Well, at the very least, if it's like, okay, they just added two new board members who are industry veterans, and the activist investor is one of them there. You think that's going to kind of change the dynamics then in the governance and how they're discussing things potentially. So, and having these new committees. So, I mean, you're right. Maybe this is it, but it doesn't feel like we can put the book down just yet on this.
Exactly.
Like there's more to see, like this will be really interesting to follow, like what happens with the company going forward.
But in other news, they did talk about pulse field ablations growth.
Yeah. And really growing well for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So lots of good news coming out of
they're competing a lot with Medtron, with Boston Scientific on this. So that's good news for them that it's growing so much. And I want J&J is out there with Farapulse. They also had Hugo News. They said that they're expecting to do a launch of Hugo in the back half of their present fiscal year, which ends in April, 2026. So, hey, they're still working, moving forward on Hugo. They also got that CE mark for that ligature vessel sealing system that works with Hugo. And then there's that renal denervation news. And actually also, like, on top of the American Heart Association, there's like been a proposed CMS national coverage determination to recommend insurance coverage for renal denervation. So that could be a really, really good catalyst if that goes through. So
that'll be huge for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So, it almost seems like every time I listen to a Medtronic earnings call, I hear their CEO, Jeff Murthy, these days talking about like, oh, we're getting to this inflection point. I know the growth hasn't been as much as we're going to get there. We're going to grow. But, even the analysts were kind of saying like, hey, we think this could start to pick up now, they have stuff like renal denervation and the pulse field ablation that could kind of get them going. So, and then, yeah, maybe, hey, maybe having this, working with Elliott, that could, help them, maybe help them with some of the execution, So we'll see.
Sounds great. Yeah. All right, Chris Newmarker. Great, Newmarker's newsmakers as always. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. Take care.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris Newmarker, for the Newmarker's newsmakers. Now we're going to roll into the FOMO part of our Device Talks weekly show. Kayleen, why don't you talk just a little bit about FOMO? It's a relatively new addition to the show, and folks can listen on this podcast, but they can find the FOMOs elsewhere, can't they?
Exactly. We're at the point now that we've had, if you can believe it, 10 segments of our Future of MedTech Opportunities series, where we're looking at what could the future of medtech innovation look like in the near and long-term future. And it's been received so incredibly well. And we're actually collecting all of these FOMO interviews in our central repository, our Device Talks eHub. So I'm going to actually give you the link to that, Tom, so you can put in the show notes so that our audience can access that. So if you haven't listened in every week, well, first of all, I'm gutted to hear that. But that's okay. You have time to catch up. Just follow Device Talks on any major podcast player. Check out that link in the show notes and get caught up on all of the FOMO episodes that we've had. And we're going to continue to feature a FOMO every Device Talks weekly. So I hope you continue to enjoy, because I know I have loved every second of it. And for those who are going to be joining us live at Device Talks West here in October, we're actually going to be recording the FOMO interviews live. So another reason to join us on site and check out when the magic is being created right in front of you.
That's right. They could be part of the FOMO experience. So without any further delay, let's bring in David Nielwani. He, of course, is Director of Business Development for Healthcare and Medical at NVIDIA. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom. I'm excited to talk to you a little bit about what NVIDIA is doing in the healthcare medtech space.
So we're looking at the future of medtech, and I can't think of a company that's more invested in that than NVIDIA. You folks are doing a lot of impressive work, a lot of impressive medical device companies, and really seem to be, over the last couple of years, driving this sector forward with your partnerships. So we're talking about surgical robotics, but other things as well. But how did you come to join NVIDIA?
Well, kind of an interesting story, Tom. And from a career perspective, I've always been in technology. So in med tech, but on the technology side of med tech.
Okay.
And, I started my career with a semiconductor company that had a wide portfolio of connectivity products, and just kind of that passion for healthcare and frankly, using technology to make a fundamental change in the way healthcare is delivered. One of the areas that, I initially saw was, couldn't believe that all these medical devices in the early 2000s were not connected to the internet. It's like the internet was growing, they weren't connected.
Right.
But, that first step was, how do we actually get into those design cycles and begin embedding connectivity into those devices? And, really we spent, frankly, a 10-year journey connecting all of these medical devices, where I just realized now we have another problem. No one really thought about where is all of this data going. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that kind of had me join a small embedded software company that was looking at the interoperability challenge called RTI. And then with RTI putting together partnerships, I saw a lot of that data was going to reside in the cloud. So I spent the previous 3 years to NVIDIA at AWS and really learning kind of about that digital transformation at the IT level. And then
still medical for AWS?
Still medical. So I was leading up their marketing for the medical and healthcare side of that practice. And then strangely enough, as Kimberly and team were growing from healthcare and life sciences, they were looking for somebody with medical device and med tech experience. And from that, having the cloud experience and then, you know, frankly, learning about what I knew as a gaming company, really diving deep, and Kimberly's vision and Jensen's vision for what they wanted to do and transform healthcare made so much sense. And I also saw the frankly, even though they were platforming, the cloud companies were still very fragmented. You know, you had a couple of them and you had to choose your platform. The fact that NVIDIA has this vision to essentially platform across all clouds, all embedded compute, all data center compute, frankly, kind of gave, you know, not only healthcare, but all industries what they generally need, a standard platform to begin building upon. And, you know, it's just been an absolutely exciting opportunity. I mean, frankly, kind of watching this organization grow, and we're going through a lot of the same transitions that our customers are going through, transitioning from, I'd say, a hardware centric model to something that is frankly more software centric, because I think we see our customers investing a lot more time, effort, and energy, and they should be in software.
Talk a bit about that problem of the different cloud platforms that medical device companies have to work with. What problem does that create for the medical device companies? It's just the sheer fact that Medtronic will be on this one and Boston Scientific will be in that one, and we don't have that universal connection that we need to make this all work.
Well, I'd say the good news at frankly kind of a device level, it doesn't matter as much. I think it matters much more when you start getting to this new transition that we're trying to bring at the edge, because at the edge, which is think the hospital, it is the OR, it is the radiology suite, it is the ICU. Rarely do you ever standard on one single company's devices. So how do you actually begin creating this kind of idea of an integrated OR or an integrated ICU?
Right.
You know, unless it's a single company kind of developing that end to end, which frankly, that's just really hard to do. I mean, each specific company, each specific entity kind of has their own core competency in terms of what they're building. And I think what, you know, kind of what I talked about in some of the talks today is the importance of an ecosystem. And the only way you can get an ecosystem is if you begin building a platform. And I kind of liken it to what we saw in a couple other industry revolutions was computing. It wasn't until kind of Windows came up with the operating system that you had this explosion of software built on top of it. The same came with the phone, with what Apple did in terms of their Apple App Store and their iOS. And then also what you saw, what happened with, you know, kind of Google and Android, and really kind of opened up that ecosystem for all these app developers. And, you know, that same sort of transition is happening in healthcare today, but you needed a company to verticalize that platform. Unlike these other two competing transitions that we've seen, each of those was standard across all industries.
Okay.
And I think what we're looking at now is there's unique nuances specifically to these highly regulated industries like medical that you need to, one, and this is what NVIDIA is doing, take what we've built as a core and then build on top of it and really verticalize that. And we're really doing that, Tom, in kind of three key areas that are all frankly super important to building out this AI ecosystem. You know, the first one is that edge that we talked about. So having that kind of device connectivity, real time, low latency, bringing AI, frankly, to the surgeons, to the radiologists, to the intensive care unit and the nurses that are using that. But then also what that ends up driving is this whole idea of software defined AI enabled. And with that, you realize I need an AI strategy. I need a data strategy, which then brings us to the second computer, which is for training. So you need a training computer to actually ingest all of the data, start building models based on it that can then be deployed on this edge system.
Interesting.
And then the third computer, which we just introduced this past year at GTC, is the idea of a simulation computer. And that kind of ties it all together. In these highly regulated industries, very rarely do you actually want to go forward and test on, you know, human patients. You'd much rather do your design, development, testing in a fully simulated environment. So we've basically been providing, you know, full simulated environments that now give you access to synthetic data, lets you actually build your policies and build your models and test your models in a simulated environment before you actually ever even deploy it to that edge device. So, you know, foundationally, we're trying to build this platform specifically for medtech. We kind of call it the three computers for physical AI, but one of the best embodiments of physical AI is medtech.
So with those three pieces in place, where do we go from here? What does the vision look like from NVIDIA's perspective, and what does the medtech industry look like in 5 to 10 years?
Very great questions. I think, you know, first and foremost, you need adoption of this platform. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, different parts of the hospital, you know, I mentioned kind of the ICU, the radiology suite, and the OR. If you look at kind of the way the industry's evolved in terms of adoption of AI, medical imaging is one of the first. And very rarely do they need, in many cases, real time. A lot of the AI that they're using is model development, it's perception AI, it's doing analytics on an image. Mm-hmm. They have platforms that they've already built. You know, the GEs, the Siemens, and the Philips have been, you know, at this for a period of time. But you look at the area that right now is making the biggest impact. I think, you know, we all know that ORs are the biggest revenue generators for a hospital. We know that these ORs are also, basically this is mission critical type work. So you have highly regulated mission critical type work and an opportunity to bring some significant efficiency. This entire group has never really, I'd say, considered AI and have a platform. So they're starting from scratch. So it's a very great opportunity for us to get into the ground floor with both the startups as well as the large strategics and build out that ecosystem I mentioned with a platform approach. And that's really kind of directionally where we're going. And if you think of actually taking that one step further, you know, all of these edge devices and the connectivity that, again, I kind of started my career in, you can begin now thinking almost as the whole hospital is a robot. All of the information coming from the surgical suite is actually interconnected to the data coming from the radiology suite, coming from the data from the ICU, that you start thinking of some of the analysis that you can do, you know, and the low hanging fruit, frankly, is just operationally. I mean, if you start thinking a little bit about a hospital almost as a manufacturing facility, that things need to come in and come better, you know, come out better on the other side. And how do you do that as efficiently as possible? And that's, you know, frankly, I'd say kind of getting into where do you see the next 5 to 10 years? Frankly, I see, you know, the entire medical device world kind of thinking of themselves as robots. And we think of it as physical robots, which could be something like a humanoid robot, but it also could be, you know, something like a surgical robot, or even just a device in the room that's actually aggregating data from a number of devices and, you know, making suggestions, augmenting, you know, a lot of the staff that is within that environment. And kind of the second area that we think of is the idea of digital robots. And we think of digital robots, think of that as digital agents. Mm-hmm. And these digital agents are going to be, you know, essentially there to offer advice, offering guidance, make suggestions all the way out through either surgical procedures, or in the case of, you know, an ICU, make suggestions for, you know, nurses in terms of how to prioritize, you know, the beds in their specific ward. So it's, you know, a pretty kind of foundational change to the way, you know, hospitals are doing business today, which is so, so people heavy. You're now basically going to take the people that you have there and, you know, frankly, give them superpowers. I mean, they're going to be able to, you know, operate so much more efficiently while, I think, dedicating actually more face time to the patient as opposed to a lot of the back office work and some of the other things that they have to be working on.
Well, it must be satisfying to sort of come around full circle and start checking some of the boxes that you started making a list of at the start of your career. So that's exciting stuff. David, thanks for joining us on the Future of MedTech series.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure talking and, you know, wonderful being here at Device Talks.
Thank you.
All right, well, now it's time for my keynote conversation with Ken Charhut. Once again, he is the executive chairman and CEO of a cool company called Foldax. Well, Ken Charhut, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Excited to unpack the Foldax story and some interesting new approval that is a unique one, I think, and one that folks are going to want to learn about. But as always, we love to learn about our guests. How did you find your way into the medtech industry? I see from your LinkedIn profile, you started at Baxter a bit ago.
Yes. Yeah, so maybe I'm a different type of person because it was not my desire or my thoughts when I was going through college or stuff that I would end up in the medical world. I'm a mechanical engineer by background. And
oh, really?
Worked for General Electric for a while, and actually through getting married, having to move to Chicago to make that marriage work. I left General Electric and found this company called Travenol Laboratories that was hiring folks. Uh-huh. Travenol Laboratories, you know, and then I took 17 wonderful years with that company. Starting, you know, it obviously merged with American Hospital Supply, became Baxter Healthcare. I was all over that company. I invented and introduced their pharmacy automation business. I worked in the parenterals business. And then in the early 90s, I transferred to the cardiovascular business. Uh-huh. Ran their operation in Japan for 4 years. Came back to Irvine, California, which got me in California, where I'm based right now, as president of the Bentley division, which was the cardiopulmonary division. Then worked in the heart valve division, and then in about 2000 or so, moved out to become a startup entrepreneur. And so for the last 25 years, I've been doing different types of startups and all over the map: heart failure, interventional, neurovascular, obesity, robotics, uh-huh. dental. So, you know, where I thought there was a great patient need.
That's great.
That's what I like doing.
Well, people get into medtech for many great reasons. Marriage yep. preservation is certainly
there you go. Certainly might a good be the one. First, right?
Certainly a good reason to do it. Let's explore, hop to your first startup experience with Orcus Medical. And I'm saying that right? ORQIS?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's thought right. so. That was in the congestive heart failure space. What was that transition like from a large company to small? Did you at any time earlier in your career see yourself as a startup CEO? And how did you find your way there? And how did you take a job in January 2000? I mean, that was an interesting time for medtech. The bubble was about to burst. You know, things were about to go haywire. What was that transition like to startup?
Yes, it's it's an interesting story. I'm an engineer, right? Went to First of Baxter, got in the engineering department, and, you know, would say I'm a adequate engineer, but was not up in the top 10%. So when I looked around, I go, you know, my odds of being the VP of engineering at a big medical device company are probably limited. What else is here for career growth? You
know? So it's a good, honest conversation to have.
I got my MBA, right? And said, you know, okay, I got to learn marketing and sales here, how the business works. Because I said, you know, the one thing I do have is I have an eclectic interest in a bunch of different things. I like uh-huh. to finance, whatever. And you know who really does well? That guy at the top. Set off. That's what got me really in the pharmacy automation business, where I started that. And I was, you know, they gave me the opportunity to market it, to sell it, and then kind of run that division. So I always like kind of making things, that engineering thing, and then being able to talk with and have a lot of people working for me. So that kind of was what gelled it. Moving to Japan, you're on a whole different time zone, right? Uh-huh. For the US, and you're sitting there with, you know, the largest segment of profit contribution to the Baxter, organization. So you're high visibility, but not a lot of support, right? You're out there on your own. So
no Zoom calls back then. Yeah.
Pardon?
No Zoom calls back then. You couldn't.
No. It's a telephone call, and people had to be awake to take that telephone exactly. call for the most part, right? So, you know, you really, it was great for me. Learning a different culture, learning a different thing, and really making a lot of, you know, high value decisions. And so I truly enjoyed that came back to the US and, you know, now you're back in the larger company organization and the skills and the problems that you solve in a larger corporation are, they're different than when you're out there on your own making them. So, you know, through that, I loved the company. I loved everything, but I thought, you know, I kind of like more maybe the challenge of making the decisions, and, you know, and living with the risks of those than, you know, the team approach that you kind of go through with larger corporations. So that was the impetus to move out, and try, you know, try the startup world.
Like my son returning from college and living at home, after being on his own for a couple of years, like he definitely appreciates the freedom he used to have versus what he might have today. So,
yeah. Exactly. So, you know, so that moved out and, you know, the biggest difference really was that lack of support.
Yeah.
Right. When you move out into the startup world, it almost the first feeling really Tom, which lives with me to this day was why do I have all this free time? Uh-huh. Maybe I'm not working hard enough. Maybe I don't know this startup thing. And I went and I looked back at my calendar and I realized 80% of my calendar when I was working for Baxter was an operating review meeting. It was a global operating review meeting. Yep. It was a strategy meeting. They were meetings, right? And when you strip all that out and you just start thinking about it, you got 80% of your time, you're not doing that, right? And it quickly fills, you learn how to fill it, but, that was probably the biggest, you know, issue. I had the confidence to try to make the decision going forward, but that, you know, the lack of the meeting and the realization of how much time you actually spend doing that in a larger organization was kind of what sat with me on the transition.
That's great. So you're with Orcus for 9 years. What was the outcome of that? How did that story end?
We ended up with a clinical trial that had a combined endpoint, and we won both arms of the combined endpoint. But because we combined them together, they had to correlate very well. And it turned out in heart failure, it's a very complex thing. And the two things we picked didn't correlate very well. So all the power we had on each arm didn't translate into a power in the combined endpoint. So we were, you know, we were kind of in that gray zone, right?
Yeah.
Do it again. And now pick the time frame, 2007, 2008. Uh-huh. That was not a time that VCs were writing the checkbook out for the repeat trial.
And it wasn't a good time. Relations with the FDA also weren't fantastic at that time.
Correct. So, you know, so we ended up selling that. Actually, the technology went to Thoratec at that time, and that's how that ended.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it still lived on. So I know you were MindFrame, and that's got sold to Covidien.
Correct.
And Reshape, I know you experienced there. So how did you find your way to Foldex?
Well, there's one thing when I left Baxter that I did not want to do, and that was heart valves.
Because you're not answering my question.
Well, I will get to it, Don. But that's why Foldex. That's why it was 2013 when this story starts, and not 2000, because I thought they did it very well. They were, you know, tough to compete with. They had something going on, and so you know, if I'm going to go out in a startup, that's not the big dog that I want to compete with, right? But, you know, as time went on, the realization that came to me was heart valve manufacturing is probably one of the few areas in medical devices that really hasn't embraced, you know, 21st century technology.
And it's really, I was at the Edwards facility a little last year, and just seeing the room full of people hand stitching. It was kind of mind-boggling. It was like, wow, this is how it happens. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And nobody does it better, too, right? You saw the cream of the crop and, absolutely, you know, great result. But, you know, that is how it gets done, right? And if you think about it, you could take a needle, a thread, an animal tissue,
and almost make that back in the 1500s, right?
Yeah.
Just new materials, new whatever. So that was just a thought I had in the back of my mind all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And then an opportunity came with a couple of folks who had some knowledge in the polymer, and a polymer that they thought would work for heart valves.
Mm-hmm.
So biostable, biocompatible, again, interesting, but I hadn't put two and two together here yet. And I'm like, you know, well, Edwards is doing very well right now. They're like, hey, this is engineered material. We can actually design a valve on the computer here with this, because you know the bond strength of this material and how it works. And, you know, I think we can do this robotically. And then it was like, okay, like this is an asymmetric entry into heart valves, right? You have a biostable, compatible material, can work like a tissue in terms of its anticoagulation properties, right? It's got durability that would meet what a mechanical valve would be, and you make it robotically. So your precision, your cost structure, your efficiency, you know, is, it goes down, and you can democratize that. We can put these pods anywhere you want in the world. So it was like, okay, maybe, you know, I can push this industry into the 21st century here.
Amazing.
Right. And it's an asymmetric entry. So
what does that mean? Asymmetric entry?
Well, if you look at, what's happening today. So you have, I have a self-expanding stent on Medtronic. I have a balloon expandable stent, Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
I have $300 million of marketing to support my claims and to do the clinical trial. You come out with a tissue-based product that has one of those two platforms. How do you get your, you know, where's your noise level to get noticed?
Right.
What's that entry? You're entering the same game that's already out there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But when I enter as a Palmer valve with a patient proposition, right, which says, hey, if a tissue, you may need one or two of these, depending on your age, right? With a mechanical, you're going to need to have anticoagulation. It makes noise. You know, you're going to hear it. I got a third option for you, the patient, right? Well, you can't really market against that, right? It's a different story for the patient as a patient comprehends it of what his choices. Clearly, as a company, we have to prove the statements that I made, but that's a story direct to the patient that makes a difference of them. And then when I come in at an efficiency and a precision factor better than, you know, the 1,000 folks that you saw over at Edwards, now we have an asymmetric entry into the business side of it. That's really what catalyzed me to make this thing go, to, you know, try to give it a shot.
So you, what was it? Give us I want to unpack that in a moment, but give us a bit of the origin story. Where did the polymer come from? How did this technology come to be? And how did someone come to you? Did you come to it? How did you all come together?
It kind of came to me, the material, a couple of folks that had worked at a company called, Aortech, had transitioned out. They were working with this class of polymer. They had licensed it to St. Jude. St. Jude had put it on their pacing leads. They had like 15 years of experience, and they came and they said, hey, it's great for that. But if you want to use it for a leaflet, you know, it may need to be engineered a little differently. So the source of this was a research organization called CSIRO out of Australia. It's a bit, their NIH equivalent. These guys, if you've ever been to Australia, you realize they got a plastic currency. These are the dudes that made that. You know, so they know biostable for long periods of time. And we said, hey, we like this class. It's been proven to be biostable. It's been proven to be biocompatible. but we'd like you to engineer it so it has the flexibility of a, you know, of a leaflet that you're going to need for a heart valve. And so that was, that's where the material came from. They re-engineered it. We have 21 patents on what the output of it. You know, it's a unique polymer, but it's able to capture the same qualities of that class of materials that had been proven in medical, you know, implantable situations for durability. So that's kind of, you know, where that originated from. And then we took not only the polymer, but how to make the polymer and brought it to Salt Lake City. So we begin with bags of chemicals and, you know, produce the polymer. We have all the know-how sitting at our own facility.
And what are the traits of a successful material in this space? Durability, you mentioned, I imagine there's flexibility and things. What are some of the qualities?
Yeah, so it has to be kind of impervious to the types of factors that are in your blood that break down tissue. So calcium is the bane of every tissue valve.
Okay.
Right? They recalcify. It begins to degrade it. It begins to make it not so flexible. And that's kind of the reason you got your heart valve in the first place, is because you're a patient that's susceptible to calcification.
Uh-huh.
And so the animal tissue is going to calcify as well. And that's the slow degradation of a tissue valve.
Okay.
There's some other factors. So one, you have to avoid those attack agents, right? So you don't degrade it. Second thing is you think of a potato chip bag, right? You can't get the darn thing open for your life on it, but as soon as you do, boom, you've used so much force, you rip the entire bag out and the potato chips are all over the floor.
Yeah.
Right. So you want a polymer that doesn't have that failure method, right? That, you know, as soon as it does get pierced or whatever, that it just rips and dissolves. That the other thing you don't want a credit card failure, what we call, right? Which is, you know, if you bend your credit card enough times, it'll crack it. You can get it in half. I mean, that's what's happening with your leaflet and your heart every time. You have long chains, you have short chains in the polymer, and you need the right combination of those. The short chains make the flexibility, the longer chains make the, you know, the strength of it. And so you're really, you know, cooking up this cocktail, which, you know, is going to not attract any of the types of things floating in your blood that could create a degradation. And then you don't want long-term for any of these factors to create, you know, a tear or something in the valve. So
I imagine achieving all of this is creating a material that achieves all that is a difficult thing to do. I mean, it obviously, I don't mean to be wise about it, but what is so special about your polymer as opposed to another polymer?
It's a great question, because if this was easy, I don't think animal tissue would ever be used.
Fair
right?
point.
I mean, yeah, it's not like somebody wasn't trying. The original Edwards ball valve was, you know, metal and a plastic ball.
Yeah, so, good point.
So
yeah.
That's where we started. So, you know, engineered materials, right? Certainly made. We're an advantage of years of just progress in material science in how to characterize these things, how to catalyze them, synthesize them into materials. And the fact that, you know, corollaries of this have been used in humans to show that it is durable. So the field has advanced. Robotics have advanced on how to do it, and computer design has advanced, right? So we say the last point is an important point, because if you're taking an animal tissue, something you can characterize it as well as we can, but it's a biologic tissue, which means it's not going to be the same every time. And so you have to, I think this is how it's going to work. And then you do experiments to prove that. We don't have to do those experiments. Uh-huh. We can do those experiments on a computer, right? We can actually design it. We can see where the stresses are. We can see where it goes over the bond strength of the material. What we're doing is just validating that what we saw and the experimentation we did on the computer, in fact, plays out uh-huh. in reality. So it's almost flipping the script of how you do this.
Interesting. Was the plan always to develop your own valves, or did you explore being a supplier to others who make valves?
Well, great question, Tom, because you're asking it. My investors ask this question.
You know, everyone, so, I'm not an investor. I want everyone to know that. Yes. I have no stakes in Folex or any other medtech company.
But you're a very smart man and to ask the question. So there's one thing I learned in my experience, because I actually had the opportunity to introduce the class of tissue valves that are now dominating the market back in Japan. Right. And the tissue valves did not have a great reputation then. Mm. The general belief was they're going to wear out in 5 years. And a mechanical valve is much better. St. Jude dominated the market at that time with the pyrolytic carbon valve. And, you know, fast forward to today, right? And tissues dominate the market. You know, why? What was that? It's just basically the same tissue. But it was an Eljoloy frame that Baxter Edwards at that time had developed that married the leaflet with the frame to reduce stresses, strains, and make the whole valve work. So, yes, I have this polymer, but this polymer has to work with a frame that marries together to create a valve. Uh-huh. So I can't just give you, and we don't make leaflets. We dip all of the leaflets at one time. It's a liquid, the polymer's a liquid, and then we actually form the valves, all three of them together. So I can't just sell you leaflets that you can sew in and know that it's going to work, because I need to know your frame design. I need to know how the interaction between the polymer material and your frame is going to work. So could it work? Possibly, but not necessarily. And probably more than likely, no, because you designed it for tissue. You didn't design it for my polymer.
Uh-huh. So let's then talk about your valve, the Tria mitral valve. How did you settle on doing a mitral valve? And give us a little background as to its design and where it is in development, and we can talk about regulatory as well.
We're a platform company, so we actually have an aortic valve. We have a TAVR valve. Yeah, you know, okay. we can form factor this into all the valves. Our lead valve is the mitral valve. Almost mitral valves, if you have a replacement today, are done surgically. They're not done percutaneously like the aortic side.
Okay.
Our number one issue we felt from the company and the mission going forward was proving that this polymer was effective and would deliver on its promise. There's people way smarter than us, equally as smart as us, that can design valves, right? That's not necessarily the great value that Foldex is bringing forward. Foldex is bringing forward that valve in a polymer fashion, right? Uh-huh. So from the very beginning of the company, it was, how can we demonstrate that? How can we show the impact that can have? And then as we move it into other form factors, and if you look at the TAVR market, you have a delivery system. You have, is it balloon expandable? Is it self-expanding? You know, does it have commissure alignment? There's 100 little factors of that particular product that have nothing to do with the polymer. So we felt if we spent all our time doing that right out the bat and we had no data on the polymer, you know, that's a tough place to be, because the Edwards and Medtronic is just going to go, why the heck would you want to use that? I've got 10 years of data. I got seven years of data, right? So the surgical valve, simpler valve, less complicated. It's got a frame. It's got leaflets. It's got a sewing cuff on it. Three components, basically, is all that it's made from. Now, where can we put the highest impact? Going in the aortic is not necessarily the highest impact, because most of those valves today are delivered percutaneously, not surgically. So, and tissue valves tend to wear out much faster in the mitral position.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, our very first patient, the reason, which was done in the U.S., right? And you ask, why would somebody raise their hand, right, to get a polymer valve, first in the world, first in whatever, you know, his story was his sister had tissue mitral valves and had two of them and was facing a third surgical operation and turned it down. And he said, if I can add to science something that makes no one have to face what my sister did, then I want to do it. And so there's the promise. That why mitral right there.
Interesting.
Now, where is that most prevalent? India. Why rheumatic heart disease? Why does it even become more acute there? Because rheumatic heart disease manifests itself at a younger age. 20 to 40 is when your valve begins to deteriorate if you have rheumatic disease.
Wow.
So, you know, now you're looking at needing something for decades.
Yeah, it's a lifetime.
And if you're a female and you go to a mechanical, you can't have children because you're on anticoagulation. Oh, really? So oftentimes what they'll do is they'll put a tissue valve in for a short period of time, right? Have your children, then come back, put a mitral valve in for the rest of your life. So being able to bring something into the market that could stop that trade-off, you know, really made sense. So it was a country that had an acute need for an improved product in the mitral position, a big market. You know, there's 50,000, 60,000 of these surgeries done every year. And because of the efficiency and because of the robotic manufacturing that we have, we could make a really healthy margin in India. We're not doing this as a charitable contribution. Mm-hmm. We've changed the whole, you know, cost structure of how you make a heart valve. So, it became a place where we could work with the government there. They needed it. They recognized that it could be good. And we were still working with the FDA. So it's not that we're like not bringing it to the US, and we'll get to the, you know, we'll get to that timing later. But again, we can develop clinical data. It's a great benefit to the society, and it's a place that then we can bring that data into the U.S. with the FDA to make them more comfortable. Rheumatic heart disease is not necessarily an acute need in the U.S., even though it does exist, and there are a fair number of patients that have that.
So you have approval in India?
So we have approval in India. We just gained that in June of this year after doing a one-year trial, and the results of that were published in JACC. And in June, and we presented that data at the New York Valve meeting that was there as well.
So let's take a moment and talk about the manufacturing of the use of robots. So do you have a setup in Salt Lake City that's going to supply the world, or are you setting up closer to the patients? Are you setting up something in India? What's the manufacturing rollout plan?
That's the strategy. So the strategy is not to have a global manufacturing facility. We call we call them pods.
Okay, that's what I thought.
You know, that the robot can make, that can make, and one robotic pod can make probably 5,000 to 7,000 valves a year. So you just duplicate that pod, and you could go put that in India. You could put two of them in India. You could do 14,000. You could just kind of, you know, do the math.
So will you have a Foldak, or do you have a Foldak site in India where this would be made, or are these robots aren't set up on the site where you're of your customers? These are, you'll have a Foldak manufacturing facility.
Correct.
India. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's a manufacturing that's not at the hospital. It's not down to, you know, handmade robot. It's not 3D printed or anything. It's an operation.
So where are you with the development, the establishment of that in India? I imagine it's up and running and ready to go.
We have a partner in India. Okay. We have not moved the robots over there. As demand comes up, we will. Right now we're able to supply that demand from the US, but then it's finished and sterilized in India. So we have a partner that does that over there. And the plan is, as the volume comes up, then we'll transfer the robotic manufacturing locally there to take advantage of the the logistics.
And looking forward, kind of wrapping up, what are the plans for the US? You'll get an enormous amount of data from India, I'm sure. What are your plans for regulatory approval in the US, and what do you see the future of the business looking like?
So we're submitting, in the next couple of weeks, we're submitting for our pivotal IDE with the FDA.
Okay.
And we've been in touch with them for 4 years. We have actually had monthly meetings with them, bring them through. You know, it's a new material, so we have to bring them, make them comfortable with what we're doing, what's coming to them. So our plan is to start that trial, you know, next year, work with the FDA on the design here between now and kind of the end of the year, and initiate that trial next year. So we have a path to commercialization in the US. And at the same time, we're working on the TAVR development version of that and going into some animals this year, early next year, and then first in man by the end of next year on that, and you know, working to bring that forward then as the next product.
Do you have any interactions with larger players out there? Anyone coming by for a cup of coffee to kick the tires, or
I don't think there's anybody that doesn't know who we are and what we're doing, and given my past, you know, clearly, they certainly, you know, follow along and, you know, I think everyone with bated breath on how we're doing.
And I know no med tech startup is for sale, but what do you see the vision looking like for what will Foldak look like in 5 years? If things go as you'd like them to.
It will be, in 5 years, it'll be a very successful company selling the full range of product from TAVR to whatever. And who will be pulling the strings to control that? You know, we'll see. I think there's a lot of interest in structural heart as it's said today. You know, the heart valve replacement market is one of the largest segments of that. So I think clearly, if you look to reality, you don't see many companies that make it very long in the public market in this space. There's usually some M&A that happens going forward. So, you know, if I was a betting person, you know, that would be my bet on where we end up. They just have distribution arms and scale factors that are much more than any startup can ever get to. But as a business, you know, we will be a business, and we can be a business. And, you know, if we have to run in a public market for a period of time, we'll be more than capable and able to do that.
And do you see your robotic manufacturing technology capabilities as another core technology of yours? And is that something that can be leveraged into other parts of medtech, or is that something simply specifically suited for the making of these valves?
I think our materials suit them to be made robotically. Where I think maybe I'd steer that question a little bit tangentially is that this material has properties. It does not like thing biological matter to grow on it. It just doesn't. We haven't seen it. It doesn't like it. And so there's many other applications, I think, in medicine where that property would be beneficial to some products. And so we're always interested in exploring, you know, with other companies, you know, with ourselves, where this material may have a instrumental benefit, you know, outside of just valve.
And final question. I think most patients sort of accept the therapies and the devices, the valves that their surgeons pick for them. Your story of the patient who made the choice to go with your valve because of the experience he had had through, I think you said his sister. My point is I think patients want to have more say and more understanding of the devices that are used on them. What is your message or what would you communicate to patients out there about your offerings? What would you say to someone who was, you were met at a cocktail party and they're telling them your problems and you wanted to sort of explain the benefits of what you're working on? What's the messaging for patients?
It's a very simple message. Our intention is not to make you have to face the choice that you have to make today if you need a heart valve replacement. We would like to offer something that gives you all the benefits that, you know, you deserve, the durability of a valve and the lifestyle that you're living today. And that's not the case that you'll get today. And our aim is to remove that choice from you and give you a better option.
Fantastic. Well, it's exciting, obviously important clinical area, exciting approach with the material and with the manufacturing. So checking a lot of boxes there. Ken Charhut, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, happy to do it. Thank you. Great questions. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly, the show formerly known as the Device Talks Weekly podcast. Kayleen Brown, you're sticking around for the not so bitter end. It's great to connect with you over video, but we'll be seeing each other in just a few weeks. Oh, but before we, little teaser, before we get into that, next week, the first week of September on Device Talks Tuesdays, we'll be conducting one of our deep dive interviews with Testar Larvia of BD. He gave a great presentation at Device Talks Boston, and we'll be unpacking that. You and I, Tesh is a joy to talk to, and that is sponsored by S3 Connected Health and Electrocraft. So folks should definitely register for that, and they can be part of the conversation as well. So that will be our next digital meeting. But then after that, Kayleen, what's next?
Well, after we have that fantastic conversation, so I do hope everybody can tune in and get more Tom and Kayleen, we will be meeting in person for the conclusion of our MedTech Nerd Tour for 2025. It's a three-leg stop. We're going to be in Menlo Park for the MedTech Women MedTech Vision Conference, and then we're going to head over to AdvaMed, and then we're going to close out the Nerd Tour. And of course, Device Talks West, that's October 15th and 16th, and I know I can't wait for that, so we're going to have lots of coffee, lots of chatting about MedTech, lots of one-on-one time. Bring it on!
And that's great. And if folks want to join us, once again, use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25% and go to west.devicetalks.com. We're in the midst of you'll see some branding. We're calling that the Device Talks Innovation and Industry Forums. We're moving into a new name, but still using our Device Talks West packaging as well. So go to west.devicetalks.com, use the code DTWeekly25, save 25% off the price of registration, and please join us in Santa Clara. All right, Kayleen. Well, great to having you on the Device Talks Weekly show, and let's keep kicking some podcast butt.